Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my pleasure to introduce you to the music you'll be hearing at the festival. For Music at Menlo's 17th season, we'll explore seven incredible decades, singular periods in Western music history that saw intense concentration of the art form's evolution at the hands of its greatest innovators. We'll hear music of the 1710s, when Bach created some of his most inspired instrumental music. On our second and third concert programs, we'll visit the 1790s, when Beethoven emerged as the heir apparent to Haydn and Mozart, and the 1820s, when Beethoven and his own natural successor, Franz Schubert, penned their profound final works. From there, we'll visit the apex of the Romantic period, hearing music from the 1840s by Schumann, Chopin, and Mendelssohn. We'll hear the explosion of new musical styles that marked the 1890s and the Roaring Twenties. And our musical time travel will conclude with the final decade of the last millennium, with works by some of today's vital compositional voices. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han and Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts. As the 20th century approached, German and Austrian dominance of Western music began to fade, giving way to a galaxy of voices from France, Russia, Bohemia, and beyond. The late music of Brahms, emblematic of German Romanticism, serves as an anchor in Concert Program 5, Moscow to Montmartre, a program of music that spotlights a cosmopolitan collection of composers of the era.
The Czech composer Josef Suk entered the Prague Conservatory as a violinist in 1885 when he was just 11 years old and began composing in earnest during the third year of his studies. He composed his piano quartet in A minor opus 1 in 1891 as his graduation piece, but remained at the conservatory for an additional year to study with Antonín Dvořák, who had joined the faculty in January. During this time, Suk also played second violin in the Czech quartet. Following a successful debut in Vienna in 1893, the quartet steadily rose to prominence as the preeminent Czech chamber ensemble of its day. For his part as a composer, Suk took his place as Dvořák's star pupil, as well as, eventually, his son-in-law when he married Ottilie Dvořák in 1898. By the turn of the century, Suk, still just in his early 20s, had established himself as his teacher's heir apparent in the realm of Czech composition. He became a significant pedagogue in his own right, teaching composition at the Prague Conservatory, where his students included Bohuslav Martinů, among others. The lion's share of Suk's oeuvre comprises instrumental music. He wrote few songs and never ventured into opera. Yet, surprisingly for an accomplished quartet violinist, he wrote little chamber music, and much of it dates from early in his career. In addition to the piano quartet, Suk's string quartet in D minor, piano trio in C minor, opus 2, and piano quintet in G minor, opus 8, were written during his student years. Nevertheless, these and other early works reveal a fully consolidated compositional voice.
The piano quartet is fittingly dedicated to Dvořák. Yet, while the elder master's influence can be heard, the work more compellingly reveals striking originality for a composer of 17. Unlike Dvořák, Janáček, and others of his mentors and contemporaries, Suk drew virtually no inspiration from Czech folk music or literature. The full ensemble gives forceful voice to the Allegro Appassionato's dour opening theme. Long-breathed, extroverted melodic lines are distinguished by ear-catching chromatic turns. A B-flat in the fourth measure, a C-sharp three measures later, notes brazenly foreign to the home key of A minor, signaling a harmonic restlessness that animates the first subject. The second theme is in fact but a sly transfiguration of the first. The rhythmic drive of the movement's opening persists, but now propelling a honeyed melody in C major, introduced by the cello and paced by offbeat chords in the piano. Suk's high-octane treatment of his thematic materials and continued harmonic movement infuse the development section with a nervous agitation. As if worn, but not defeated, the theme returns in the home key of A minor, not in forte octaves as before, but in the piano, colored by soft chords in the strings. The second theme, too, reappears, now in radiant A major. Though emitting soft moonlight in place of the Allegro Appassionato's white heat, the Adagio retains the first movement's alluring harmonic abandon. The espressivo theme, issued by the cello atop placid chords in the piano, outlines three tritones in its first breath. As violin and viola enter the frame, a quintessentially romantic picture comes into focus. Rhapsodic lyricism tinged with an underlying anxiety. The tempo quickens for a middle section in remote D major. Delicate cascading triplets in the piano, like gentle rain on a sunlit day, surround rejuvenated melodic lines in the strings. The music blooms into a fortississimo climax, then an abrupt silence. With a cello recitative, Suk seems to bring the blissful reverie back to reality, only to reprise the opening theme, now more transcendent than anything that came before. The quartet concludes with a vigorous allegro con fuoco finale, driven by a brisk march-like theme. Intervening episodes vaguely recall material from the previous two movements, the dotted rhythm and melodic contour of the Allegro Appassionato's main theme, the slow movement's aching legato. Finally, Suk's precociously constructed Opus 1 arrives at a sure-handed conclusion, prophesying a musical voice that would rank among the most distinguished of the early 20th century. Claude Debussy is universally recognized as one of the most influential musical voices of the 20th century. To the ears of many music lovers, his landmark work of 1894, Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, represents the beginning of a new era in music. The composer and conductor Pierre Boulez wrote that with this work, quote, "the art of music began to beat with a new pulse," end quote. Debussy's unique approach to harmony, rhythm, and orchestration yielded a distinctly French musical voice, as distinguishable by its color and inflection from the prevailing German idiom, as the spoken languages are different. This musical language became known as Impressionism, a term borrowed from the visual arts, and specifically the work of Claude Monet. As applied to the music of Debussy, the term describes a rich palette of harmonic colors and instrumental timbres. While he is known for having cultivated a French style, the Frenchness of Debussy's music constitutes but one aspect of his compositional language. Debussy had insatiably open ears and absorbed a broad musical spectrum, from American jazz to Indonesian gamelan, which he discovered at the 1889 World's Fair in Paris. This penchant for a variety of musical cultures included a visceral draw to the music of Spain.
Debussy's string quartet dates from early 1893, 1 year prior to the completion of Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Both works signal the onset of the composer's early maturity. The quartet mystified listeners at its premiere. Its unfamiliar tonal effects and liquid form represented a striking departure from the stalwart quartet canon of Beethoven and Brahms. The poet Stéphane Mallarmé once identified French symbolism's ethos as, quote, to evoke in a deliberate shadow the unmentioned object by elusive words, end quote. This aspiration finds its musical analog in Debussy's quartet, whose character reflects the composer's sympathy with the symbolist writers. The exotic flair of Spanish folk music likewise marks the piece, as in the opening theme, which serves as the germinal motive for the entire work. Gales of 16th notes in the middle strings propel soaring melody in the first violin, then in the cello. Debussy expands his range of sound colors further still as the first violin presents the lyrical second theme above billowing triplets in the second violin and cello. A new melodic idea appears, marked doux et expressif, sweet and expressive, but the languid air is punctured by the cello's insistent utterances of the opening motive. The movement demonstrates the trappings of a classical sonata form movement and features a development section as finely crafted as those of Beethoven and Brahms. Yet, the vivid palette of colors and textures, conjuring wind over the open seas, is uniquely Debussy's own. The consequential opening motif persists, driving the music to its decisive recapitulation. Debussy derives the scherzo's opening measures from the germinal motif presented in the first movement. This motive serves as an insistent ostinato beneath a tart pizzicato theme, while strummed chords and pizzicato melodies evoke the sound of flamenco guitars. Blustery 16th note figures, like strong winds escaping the first movement and sweeping into the second, support long-breathed melodies. The Andantino third movement opens in a soft haze, all four instruments playing with muted strings. The movement makes frequent references to the first movement's germinal motif. The languid introduction to the final movement likewise arises from the quartet's opening figure. Throughout the remainder of the finale, Debussy continues to recall and transform the germinal motif. By the quartet's conclusion, its initial utterance has guided the listener through a kaleidoscopic journey, and it arrives at the work's final cadence considerably changed. Thank you.
Johannes Brahms's three intermezzos, Opus 117, composed in 1892, illustrate the character of the piano music of the composer's final years. Like the Fantasien, Opus 116, also composed in 1892, and the six pieces, Opus 118, and four pieces, Opus 119, completed the following year, the intermezzos are subtle but powerful works. If autumnal is an overused descriptor for Brahms's late music, it is nevertheless applicable here. Edward Hanslick observed Opus 117's, quote, thoroughly personal and subjective character, pensive, graceful, dreamy, resigned, and elegiac, end quote. Brahms himself referred to the intermezzos as lullabies of my sorrow. They are lullabies indeed, especially the first of the set, a gently rocking andante moderato in the warm key of E-flat major. Brahms includes two lines of verse translated from the Scottish ballad Lady Anne Bothwell's Lament as a preface to the score. Ballow, my babe, lie still and sleep. It grieves me sore to see thee weep. Brahms's tender melody, initially offered piano dolce, bears a distant resemblance to the traditional Scottish tune. Each of the three intermezzos is in ternary or ABA form. Following the statement of the lullaby theme, pallid octaves descend into a dark middle section in E flat minor. As the music's tenor turns troubled, the polyphonic texture grows thornier. The intermezzo concludes with an easy return to the opening E-flat major section, as if comforting a child distressed by a bad dream. The inner voices become still more brilliant, and the final measure radiates a soft glow. The second intermezzo, marked Andante non troppo and set in the key of B flat minor, features spare yet highly developed keyboard writing. It begins with a swirl of 32nd notes, introspective, enigmatic, and austere. Brahms rarely sets more than two voices sounding at once. By contrast, the resolute B section, in the relative key of D-flat major, is packed with lush chords. In his biography of Brahms, the composer and critic Walter Niemann has compared this middle passage to, quote, a man as he stands with the bleak, gusty autumn wind eddying round him, end quote. The Andante con moto in C-sharp minor begins on an understated note. The opening melody, presented in octaves, molto piano e sottovoce sempre, remains primarily fixated on its opening three pitches. It is simple music, presented in simple fashion, yet gives rise to a quietly devastating musical statement. Here is the leading voice of late Romanticism foreshadowing the expressionist tendencies of the early 20th century. Brahms counters the melodic and harmonic simplicity of the opening material with a chromatically rich central section, marked dolce ma espressivo. Indeed, it is music whose sweet embrace belies its expressive ferocity. On the occasion of his graduation from the Moscow Conservatory in 1892, Sergei Rachmaninoff received that institution's highest honor, the Great Gold Medal, for his one-act opera Aleko. The work caught the attention of Russian music's most revered figure. Tchaikovsky was so taken by what the 18-year-old Rachmaninoff had created that he arranged for it to appear the following year as part of a double bill, alongside a work of his own at the Bolshoi Theater. Tchaikovsky subsequently advocated for Rachmaninoff to the publisher Guteil. The publication of his Prelude in C-sharp minor, which quickly became and remained the young composer pianist's calling card, helped to launch Rachmaninoff's career. Buoyed by this early success, Rachmaninoff enjoyed a prolific summer in 1893, completing two sets of songs, the orchestral fantasy The Rock, and the fantasy tableau for two pianos, Opus 5. At the time of the fantasy tableau's completion, Rachmaninoff, who deified Tchaikovsky in any case, moreover had reason to feel personally indebted. Rachmaninoff showed Tchaikovsky the score and requested, and received, permission to dedicate the work to him. Tchaikovsky also agreed to attend the work's premiere, but died on November 6, 3 weeks before the performance. Rachmaninoff designed the fantasy tableau as a series of musical pictures, according to a letter to his cousin, Natalia Skalon. The published score prefaces its four movements with lines of verse by Mikhail Lermontov, Lord Byron, Fyodor Tyutchev, and Alexei Komyakov, respectively. Scholars differ as to whether the movements are programmatic or merely share an emotional tenor with the poem cited. At dusk half heard the chill wave laps beneath the gondola's slow oar. Once more a song, once more a twanged guitar. Now sad, now gaily ringing, the barcarolle comes winging. The boat slid by, the waters clove, so time glides o'er the surge of love. The waters will grow smooth again, but what can rouse a passion slain?
In addition to these lines from Lermontov, the opening barcarolle might also record the Venetian gondola songs from Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words. It shares with those miniatures its tranquil rhythmic lilt, its air of mystery and romance, but with Rachmaninoff's Russian soul embedded in its melodic and harmonic character. The primo part, or first piano, accompanies a seductive tune in the secondo, or second piano, with rippling ascending gestures, at once evocative of a strummed guitar and Lermontov's wave lapping beneath the gondola's oar. Rachmaninoff makes use of the piano's full range of colors, from the crystalline shimmer of both keyboards playing in their high registers to the resonance of their middle and low range. The dual keyboard texture grows increasingly lush as the Barcarolle enters a middle G major section, supporting a suave melody in the primo. As the movement returns to the previous G minor music, its heightened textural intricacy and sustained virtuosity recast the romantic air as devilish derring do. The second movement is spellbinding from the start. An opening horn call in the secondo invites rising chords, then swelling arpeggios like an early morning mist in the primo. Birds awaken in the secondo as the music proceeds, evoking Lord Byron's poem, "It is the hour."
It is the hour when from the boughs the nightingale's high note is heard. It is the hour when lovers' vows seem sweet in every whispered word, and gentle winds and waters near make music to the lonely ear.
From its languid opening, the movement blossoms into an impassioned ecstasy. The slow descending pattern at the start of the sorrowful third movement reflects the epigraph taken from Fyodor Tchouchev.
Tears, O human tears, flowing day and night, flowing unseen by anyone, endlessly, endlessly. The pouring rain becomes a torrent into the dead autumn night.
This movement is a morose affair from the disconsolate opening to its dirge-like coda, with no contrasting humor to offer the listener respite. But this funereal end is followed, fittingly, by resurrection. The fantasy tableau's final movement is a celebration of Russian Easter. Rachmaninoff incorporates the Russian liturgical crisis-risen chant with the clangorous church bells. The published score quotes Alexei Komyakov.
Across the earth, a mighty peal is sweeping till all the booming air rocks like a sea, as silver thunders carol forth the tidings, exulting in that holy victory. Audio notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering was provided by Dahong Situ. Production support was provided by Nathan Pear. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Yosef Suk's Piano Quintet in A Minor Opus 1, performed by Wu Han, Alexander Sitkovetsky, Yura Lee, and David Finkel, and Sergei Rachmaninoff's Fantasy Tableau for Two Pianos Opus 5, performed by Wu Han and Alessio Bax, appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Johannes Brahms's Three Intermezzos Opus 117, performed by Wilhelm Kempf, appears courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Claude Debussy's String Quartet, performed by the Jupiter Quartet, is available on Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.